It is Locked On Jazz because we had to. A special edition. Locked On Jazz coming your direction. Jazz lose in Miami, trade Dante Exum, acquire Jordan Clarkson, cut Jeff Green, and pick up Rajon Tucker. An explanation of all of it coming up next on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow! How are you? I'm David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA insider. This is Locked On Jazz, your daily podcast on the Utah Jazz, giving you insight, expertise, geeky numbers, and hopefully making it a lot more fun to be a Jazz fan each and every day. As I said yesterday, the plan was to do a podcast Monday, give you postcast for today, let you have Christmas without me, podcast Thursday, postcast for Friday. That changed at 7 o'clock last night Eastern Time, 5 o'clock your time, when the Jazz traded Dante Exum. We then played an incredible basketball game. Then the Jazz waived Jeff Green, which is pretty stunning, but understandable. And then signed Rajon Tucker, who's an interesting player. So let me today kind of walk through those for you. And this will be up for a few days, and hopefully we'll get you up to date on what's going on with the Jazz and serve what you wanted. Because we say we want to make it more fun to be a Jazz fan each and every day. So hopefully this does exactly that. So we'll just do that. Thank you. First off, happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Thank you all for your support as a Jazz fan and for tuning into the show. So let's walk through it. I'm actually going to start with the game, because I actually think the game last night was one of the best of the year. And I think it relates to everything. So this was an incredible game last night. And I thought the reason the Jazz lost was because Miami was really good. That's actually why. Like, not this and that about the Jazz. Like, Miami's really good. They came with one approach to start the game. Bam Adebayo was shooting little floaters, trying to pull Rudy out. They couldn't do it. Rudy was too good. And then they had to adjust. And they made some great adjustments throughout the game. Predominantly on an offensive end, they started Nash dribbling around. They started double-teaming Donovan. They really just went and wore Donovan down in his 39 minutes of action last night. Despite the fact Donovan was plus 13, he had a tough night. He went 5-18, 1-6-3. He had 4 turnovers. They weren't going to let him shoot. He had 7 assists. He reacted well, made a great play to Rudy on a double-team that was big in the ballgame. I actually thought we were going to win that game, and then we just petered out. We just got tired. And you look, we talked about it yesterday on Locked On Jazz, how great the fourth quarters have been. And then all of a sudden we allowed 130 fourth quarter defensive rating last night, which we haven't done in a long time. And you have to wonder, 36 minutes Royce O'Neal, 38 Joe Ingles, 36 Rudy Gobert, 39 minutes Donovan Mitchell. You have to kind of believe that that plays into it. Last night was a great game. Jazz defensive rating was a 105, which was right in the middle of the pack of where they've been all season against a pretty hot offensive team, so that's good. Their offensive rating was a 105, which isn't great, not enough to obviously win the ballgame. Actually, according to some metrics, the Jazz offensive rating in some ways was almost better than Miami's, as weird as that is. And, you know, the Jazz played great. Miami just played better. Tyler Hero, three times in a row on Dante Exum late in the game scored. And scored in plays that, you know what? They were well constructed. Donovan's just got to guard Tyler Hero. Bam Adebayo is causing a mess around the basket. And so when Donovan's guarding Hero in that circumstance, you know, he made a 10-footer, he made a 7-footer, and he made a 7-footer. Those are actually probably the shots you want him to take. He made all three. Tip your hat. The real sequence of the game where it swung is it's 90-80, or excuse me, 90-85, and it's 85 all. The onslaught has come. They've opened the fourth quarter. They're trapping. They're doing all sorts of things. Bogdanović makes 2 free throws to tie it. Adebayo gets an offensive rebound to make it 87-85. Royce O'Neal makes a bad pass. Adebayo actually more than makes a bad pass. Adebayo makes an amazing play. They double team Donovan out on the wing. Jazz swing out of it correctly. O'Neal goes to make the next right pass, which is down to Gobert. And Adebayo, with insane effort and energy and play hard, and grit that Eric Spoelstra talked about before the game is a skill, gets down and intercepts the pass, leads to a pull-up fast break by Tyler Herro, which is just a big shot. I mean, that's just, they made a big shot. Now it's 90-85. The Jazz call a timeout. Bogdanovich misses a three, which was not a great look. The offense kind of struggles. And the Heat call timeout in elegant fashion as Eric Spoelstra goes in. And they run a nice, really nice play out of a timeout where instead of trying to attack Gobert, they've now made their adjustment. They're Nash dribbling and coming out the other side. And that's hard. That's really, to credit to Miami, everyone tries to attack us with pulling Rudy Gobert out and making him guard on the outside, and Rudy's gotten really good at it. The answer is to Nash dribble and then see who you pull out and flip the Jazz defense around and makes and keep your big at the rim. It makes it very difficult for Rudy. Dragic goes out, hits a 23-footer, then Derrick Jones just blows up a handoff between Bogdanovich and someone, I can't remember, and they dunk, and we're down 10 with 6:28 left. To our credit, despite all the fatigue, despite all the big minutes, despite everything else, the Jazz work their way back and try to fight their way back into that ballgame. But it's really over at that point. And give Miami great credit. But it's also a little bit related to the whole issue of the season, which is we just haven't had enough minutes. We just haven't had enough minutes off the bench. And our guys, I think, have got to be a little worn out. You know, Donovan is young, but, you know, I think if we ran the minutes played over the last period of time, our guys would be in the top part of the league. And that is just an absolute reaction to the fact that Quinn could not leave the bench on the floor any longer. In the last 10 games, Donovan Mitchell is averaging 36 minutes a game. And, you know, that's, we just, that's, now that's a lot. Like, that's not the intention. Donovan's young, so maybe you're all right. Joe Ingles is not young, and with the injury to Mike Conley and the fact that you were getting nothing out of Dante at $10 million and nothing out of Mike Conley at $30 million, you suddenly have an absolute bench weakness. And Joe Ingles over the last 10 games is playing 34 minutes a night. He's been brilliant. 15 points a game, 52% from the field, 52% from three, but it's still 30 some odd minutes a night. It's a lot. It's more than I think Joe's ever played. Joe's never averaged more than 31. We haven't played 33. So we had to make a bench move. So let's talk about Dante. First off, I've spent more time with Dante this year than probably any player, had more real conversations with Dante than I've ever had at any point, and really, really like him, just as a person. So I really hope this goes well for him. That would be my, you know, overriding thought here. As I hope this goes really, really well for him. The second thing on what Dante needs, if Dante's ever going to become a viable NBA player, is rotational player, which he has shown to be able to do. He needs 20, 25 minutes a night. We just don't have that for him right now. He's not entirely ready to go give you 20, 25 minutes a night. I know there was a lot of excitement, myself included, about how he played before the injury last year. That's a little bit of a mixed bag. And I said that at the time. There were signs. There was not a consistency. You know, for the great game in the blowout win against New York when he has 13 and the blowout loss to Philadelphia when he has 20 that has us so excited. You know, there's a 1 of 5 in 10 minutes against Oklahoma City a few nights earlier where he couldn't quite, you know, get on the floor. And then he does, you know, he comes back for three games that I don't really count. So the poor guy had not really played since January 5th. And he needs to just get out there and play 20 minutes a night of carefree basketball, regardless of impact on outcome. And we can't do that for him. And because that's what he needs, I don't actually know that he was ever going to get that time this year. You know, and in practices and things, it's clear he's not quite up to where he was before the injury. Like that's, but that's, as I've been saying for like a week, that's, there's nothing wrong with that. Like it's not fair to expect him to. So I think What Dante really needs is to go someplace and play 24 minutes a night and let it fly and just play and defend and relax and let's see what happens. He's worked so hard with Jeff Watkinson. He's worked so hard with Lamar Skeeter before that. He's worked so hard to get better. And I think that maybe this is the opportunity for it all to come together. He is going to have to buck trends. If you look at players in the history of the NBA who have 5 years experience, have shot 41% or below and 31% or below in their opening 5 years of NBA, there's very little track record for success. Greg Anthony is the best player that ever did that. From a win share standpoint, he was a good, he's a decent commentator. He was an average offensive player. None of these players who ever have, there's 33 players who in the history of the game played over 200 games, shot below 41% and below 31% in their opening five seasons. Dante's at 40 and 30, so you could stretch it out a little bit. None of them ever became above average offensive players. None of them ever have had an effective field goal percentage of over 46.8. Dante's effective field goal percentage is actually the highest of any of those players who's ever been like that. So he's the best of this group. So in fairness to him, we probably could widen the level a little bit. So he's probably the best player in this group. This is not the greatest sample I pulled. Win share-wise, he's right in the middle, which made it feel okay, but that's probably just because of limited games. So there's not a huge... Michael Carter-Williams is kind of his best track record of players at this point. If he can be what Michael Carter... He's probably a better shooter, but he's long defensive. Michael Carter-Williams... Marcus Smart is on there, but I don't think Donovan can be that kind of defensive player. There's Keon Dueling. He's kind of a more offensive-minded player in the early 2000s. Ronnie Price is right there with him. Mike Wilkes is like maybe one of the great guys ever in this league. He's actually working with Oklahoma City now. So there's some players of that sort. Deshaun Stevenson was similar early in his career in Utah. So hopefully, you know, he's able to, you know, what's interesting is all these players end up with a positive win share at some point. And, you know, Dante's the best kind of one of the better three-point shooters of this group, but, hopefully he gets it going. He is going to, the injuries have derailed him, and there is just not a huge track record at this point of someone coming through the amount of injuries with the limited performance he's had at this point. And the only way it's going to happen is if he just goes and gets a ton of time. And so that's what you have to have. You stretch the numbers out, by the way, you might get Mookie Blaylock, who is pretty decent. You kind of roll into Ricky Rubio's career a little bit. You roll into Brevin Knight's career, Speedy Claxton. If you stretch the numbers out for Dante, he ends up on the lower end of the win shares when you do this. Now you're kind of Pace Mannion actually plays into this group. You stretch it to 42% and 32% in the first 5 years. You have 75 players. Dante's at like 53rd of win share of that group. So it's just going to be you got it, right? There's just not a lot of track record. So, now let's get to it from a Jazz perspective. So the bench is a problem. Dante Exum needs this time. He's not going to get it. I don't know when he's ever going to become a viable answer for the Jazz at that point. And they really need somebody off the bench. The other one is that Dante's money now at between 9 and 11, depending on his incentives, is becoming to be a little bit of an issue. When you have other 30, it's not an issue if you don't have other $30 million players, but because you have other $30 million players on the roster, you need contributions from that. We had $41 million that was not giving the Jazz anything right now in Mike Conley because of his injury and Dante because of his injuries, and it's really hard to exist. So the fact that the Jazz were actually able to move Dante and it only cost them 2 second-round draft picks, I actually find a little stunning. So I'm impressed on that level. And then they get a player in Jordan Clarkson who's pretty good. He's 6'4", 195-pounder. He's in his seventh year in the NBA. His opening 4 years were with the Lakers, and his last three have been with Cleveland. And it's going to be really interesting to see what he is as a player, because the fact is that he is scored double figures every year of his career. He's a willing but not active passer. He's been a high usage rate player. And he's had a weird career trajectory. And let me see if I can walk through that for a second, because this is where I think we don't really know who he is as a player yet. So he goes to Missouri. I think he actually went to two colleges, if I remember correctly, but Tulsa and then Missouri. And he comes to the Lakers in 2014-15 at 22 years old. So he's a late second round. He's the second round draft picks that work. He's a established second round draft pick who's played 4 years of college. And he comes to this team that has, interestingly enough, didn't realize this, Ed Davis, Wesley Johnson, Jeremy Lin, Carlos Boozer, Jordan Hill. Like, this is a terrible, terrible Laker team. They go 21-61. So he walks onto this team that's awful as a four-year college player that's ready, and he ends up playing 25 minutes a night and actually kind of proves himself to be, on a not very good team, one of their better players. He's not efficient at all. Shoots 45% for the field, 31% from three, but he's kind of able to just play. It's kind of great for him. Well, now, like, he gets out there, he gets a lot of accolades. He's got a high usage rate. He had the fourth highest usage rate of the team behind Kobe, who played 35 games, Nick Young, who played 45, and Carlos Boozer, who played 71 at 33. I mean, this was a bad team. Well, all right. So, like, after year one, Jordan, rightfully so, kind of feeling himself. Like, all right. Like, I'm scoring 17 points per 36 minutes. I scored 12 a game. He gets to the Lakers the next year. He's 23 years old. He's now a starter. And again, they're awful. They're worse. They're 17-65. And now he's their leading scorer. He's their guy. He and Kobe. And he gets to just put it up. And he's around Mamba mentality, which I think is a bad thing, not a good thing. So Jordan Clarkson, now 23 years old, suddenly realized, wait, I got to make some money. I'm going to put up 18, 17 points a game. I'm going to make some money. The next year, and I think if we actually run through his career, he does sign a pretty good deal at some point in that process. Signs a two-year contract with the Lakers and then comes out of that, signs a multi-year deal July 7th of 2016 for $12 million a year. Okay, so it worked. But now he's been an 82-game starter. He thinks he's going to be a star in this league. Like, rightfully so. Even though the team's bad, he's putting up points. He's playing with Kobe. The next year, they're still terrible on the Lakers, 26, and he leads them again. He plays 82 games. He only starts 19 this year. They bring him off the bench because they draft D'Angelo Russell and Nick Young, and it's that whole fiasco, and he lives through all of that. He still scores 15 points a game. He's still not very efficient. So he is now a really good scorer on a bad team, is what he is. That's not his fault. He just got put on a bad team, and he's a really good scorer. He gets traded in a Larry Nance deal in February of 2018 to Cleveland. So with Larry Nance, in exchange for, what was it, Isaiah Thomas, Channing Frye, and a first-round pick. So now he's suddenly on a pretty good Cleveland team. So now this is a different world for him. Now he's on the 17-18 Cleveland team that's 50-32. It does end up, he's got kind of walks in during the middle of the medical emergency for Tyronn Lue, and Larry Drew takes up. But this team ends up going to the finals and getting swept. And now he's playing a different role. So now his career's changed. Now he's playing with LeBron and J.R. Smith and Kevin Love and George Hill and all those guys. And he plays 28 games for him. He shoots 46% from the field and 41% from three. Whoa, now he's efficient. His effective field goal percentage is 53%. He suddenly looks like he's still a gunner. He's taking 10 shots in 22 minutes, but he looks like a totally different player. And you're like, oh, well, maybe Jordan Clarkson on a good team turns out to be good. And then, so that's in 17-18. And then in 18-19, he ends up on Cleveland, and they're terrible again. So the crazy thing on Jordan Clarkson is he's played a grand total of 28 games in his NBA career while playing for a good team. Otherwise, he has played on some of the worst basketball teams the league has played. Last year, he's on a team that won 19 games. They brought him off the bench, and he was a gunner. Sure, he should be. Did a pretty good job. He was their second leading scorer. He scored 17 points a game. He shot 45% of the field. Took a ton of off-the-bounce threes, and he wasn't very efficient. And all of a sudden, this year, he's actually really changed his shot distribution, altered the amount of shots he takes. I'll dig into it for you in a second. But he's still on a terrible team. So we've got 28 games out of 411 that Jordan Clarkson has actually played on a decent team. And I'm not talking about like a sort of decent team. Like the teams he's played on won 21 games, 17 games, 26 games, and then 35 the year he got traded. So he got 28 on this. And then he goes to Cleveland, who's dreadful. Like, that would be my number one concern, and the reason I have no evaluation on Jordan Clarkson is I have no idea if he has any idea. He played 28 games of experiencing it, of the value of every possession it means to play on a really good team, because no one's asked him that other than 28 games that year. He's pretty good in those 28 games, like to his credit, right? And he comes to Cleveland. He joins in on a LeBron-laden team. Opens his, you know, scores double figures in a bunch of games. His plus minuses are actually pretty good. In the playoffs against Cleveland, he had a limited role. Cleveland-Indiana seven-game series in the first round. He didn't play much. He did not have a great series. His opening series of that playoffs in seven games against Cleveland, he goes 13 of 40 from the field. 2 of 14 from three. He shot 32% and 14% in his first playoff atmosphere. So that was a little... That was probably a little unnerving for him. He hadn't had that. Next series, he goes to Toronto. They sweep Toronto, kind of the end of Dwayne Casey. He's a little bit, he's not much better, actually. He shoots 30% and 27% from three, so that's tough. Then he goes to Boston, and they play in the Western Conference Finals against Boston. Now he's in a little bit in the swing, but his minutes are dropping a little bit in this process. He doesn't play in one of the games, and he shoots 30% and 33. And then in the finals against Golden State, he doesn't play in his last two. So he does not play well in the 2018 playoffs when he suddenly has to play at that level. So those are the biggest games he's ever played. That's the only experience he's ever had, and he was not... Okay. So that's kind of his career. And the reason I bring that all up, because I'm long-winded and I'm not taking commercial breaks today, so... is that... You know, that's a, well, I took a little commercial break in there, but not doing the local ads. So that's his career trajectory, which means I don't think we really know who he is, right? Like, he's just been in these bizarre circumstances. Now, let's look at a little bit of like what he's doing now as a player that's interesting. So this season, he's taking three catch and shoot threes a game at 42%. And he's taking two off-the-bounce threes at 29%. Okay, so that's pretty big discrepancy. He's clearly a much better catch-and-shoot guy than he was a dribble guy. Well, that's the same as it was a year ago. He was at 37% on catch-and-shoot and 27% on off-the-bounce threes, and he was taking three a game instead of two a game. And in 17-18... it's a similar story. He's at 38% catch and shoot and 30% off the bounce three. And in 2016-17, he's at 36% and 30. So that's the story of his career. Is from a three-point shooting standpoint, he is not a good off the bounce three guy. And when you put the ball in his hands and make him be the guy who makes all the plays, then that's who he is. Then that's what ends up happening. But let's look at what he's done a little bit with his shot chart of his recent time in his career, because he's beginning to change that. One, we saw a little jump up there of taking more catch and shoot than off the bounce shots. And then the pull-up shot in the middle of the lane is not a great shot for him either. And 4 years ago when he was in LA and he was taking 15% of his shots as a long two. This year he's taken 3% of those shots as a long two. So that's a really nice change. He was taking mid-range twos. He was taking 14% of his shots. This year, he's at 8%. So if you go back to kind of the 17-18 season when he split time between LA and Cleveland, he was taking 28% of his shots as long 10 feet or more twos. Now he's taking 10%. Okay, that's a big change, 28% to 10%. He's a little more active in the floater zone as he's going to the rim. He's going to the rim about the same amount of time as he did in his career, which is not a high amount. It's a decent amount. It's 23%. His rim finishing is superb. 66%. That's really high for a guard. His floater is actually pretty good. It's still bad because floaters are bad, but it's better than some other guys. It's at 44%. And his long two game, as he stopped taking him, has gotten better. He's not a great three-point shooter. But what's interesting is percentage of assisted three-point field goals is the key number for him. He's at 79%, and that usually means that he's taking it as a catch and shoot rather than an off the bounce. Okay? So that's kind of an interesting note on him. You can see it in his points gained. His points gained this year is a zero. He's a dead even offensive player. Which is, so 10%, and he goes to the free throw line 10% of his time. It's pretty good. Like, that's a decent amount for a guard. I can run you some comparisons on that. Last year, again, I have a hard time even looking at this like it matters. Like, on a just terrible Cleveland team, he was a minus 0.6. He only went to the line 9% of his time. So, interesting. Like, he took 32% of his shots as threes last year. He's taking 38% this year. Like, well, why did that change? I don't really know. It'll be interesting to talk to him about that. Maybe someone got to him. He understood it a little bit. The year before, he was a minus 0.4. He went to the line 7% of the time, and he took 27% of his shots as threes. So if you go to the 17-18 season, he's going to line 7% and threes 27%. He's now going 10% and 38%. That's a dramatic difference. His turnover rate's holding it about the same. So that's interesting. I have something called jack percentage. Jack percentage is the percentage, the length of time it takes a player to get a shot off. For example, a 4 would be he takes one shot per 4 minutes. A 1.8 is he takes one shot every 1.8 minutes. And I know that's a weird number because what's 1.8 minutes? You can probably figure it out. It's 80% of 60. His jack percentage this year is a 1.8. It's one of the highest rates in the league. Last year was a 1.75, and the year before was a 1.8. So this guy likes to shoot. That, to me, will be the most interesting aspect of how this works out. If you sort jack percentage, which is not a statistic anyone else has, it's basically usage, but it's a little different. Harden is at 1.2. Adekumbo and Kyrie Irving are at 1.3. Luka's at 1.4. Kawhi's at 1.4. Steph Curry's at 1.5. Donovan's at 1.5. Bradley Beal, D'Angelo Russell, Anthony Davis are all at 1.5. And slide down, and Jordan Clarkson's at 1.8. Same rate as Devin Booker, DeMar DeRozan, Kristaps Porzingis, Chris Middleton. Probably needs to slide down a little bit, and we'll see if he can do it. So that's Jordan Clarkson. It's a long way of getting to that, sorry. My general take on Jordan Clarkson is we need something desperately, pretty solid. No idea how he does on a good team. He's done that for 28 games his entire life. Getting that for Dante is pretty stunning to me because that's actually a quality NBA player right there who can put it in the hoop. And getting out from under Dante's contract is pretty stunning to me. So, and his team's been better with him on the floor for all that time. All right, so then we got to get to the next set of moves. So we'll do that as we continue. The Jeff Green. Jeff Green's a really interesting dude. Sat down with him before the season started. Asked him what he wanted to get better at. And he said, everything in life. And it was clearly a comment from a guy who's seen death in the eye. Jeff Green had a heart problem, major heart surgery, lost a season. Excuse me. And is a guy who I think has a different perspective on life because of that life experience of almost dying. Jeff Green might have the greatest NBA body I've ever seen in my life. And I almost think it's a curse for him. 6'8", 235, for 33 years old, I've never seen an athlete 33 years old who's that good an athlete. I thought he was superb last night. And we saw it. I mean, made an incredible pass to a rolling guy, made a cut of the baseline. But Jeff Green, maybe because he has life perspective, maybe because he's so unbelievably talented, fifth pick of the 2007 draft, he's not a play hard guy. Doesn't need to. Never has. It's just not like that grit that some guys have to survive at some point in time. That's not who he is. He's a good basketball player. He's been incredibly solid. He's going to have a 12-year NBA career, probably more. But he's not, that there's not a bite to him. He, in turn, it just didn't work. In 13 of his 30 games, we were minus 8 or more. In half the games we put him on the floor, he was minus 7 or more. Like, he wasn't playing, he's playing 14 minutes, 15 minutes, 16 minutes. It's not like, I can pull up his plus minus numbers, and it's ugly, and it's a little skewed because there were some blowouts in there, and so there's a minus 26, and there's a minus 21, and I have them ready, so I will show them to you here in a second. But and this is somewhat, frankly, consistent to Jeff Green's career. He'd had two very, very good years. The last 2 years of his career, impact on teams, both Cleveland and in Washington. The Cleveland numbers, the more I've dug into it, I think he matched with LeBron a tremendous amount of his time. And so that maybe was a little misleading. But nonetheless, we just weren't very good when he was on the floor. Like, there's not, we don't need to overanalyze this and make it a personal, if we weren't good when he was on the floor. Like, we were 10 points less good offensively, which is in the 7th percentile. We were 9 points worse defensively, which was in the 6th percentile. There's a looseness to parts of his game that leads to a mistake or two every night that kills your plus-minus. It's why, for most of his career, he's been a negative plus-minus player. He's an incredibly talented player. Like, you don't have that long an NBA career without just being amazingly gifted. Good guy, super fun to be around, light, loose, enjoyed every day. Like, don't buy. There's nothing sinister here. He didn't do something crazy. There's no other side to that story. Like, he's a super dude who, I think, you know, the fact that Mike Conley and Jeff Green went to Disney World together in Orlando right before the season start does not surprise me at all. Like, I'll bet he's a great with his kids. I'll bet he embraces every moment. And I'll bet if you wanted to find a guy in the Jazz player who you'd want to go to Disney World with, Jeff Green would be top of the list. Because he's just a good dude. And some of that, I think, is the perspective he has on the world. That perspective also might be, and I actually think in a weird way, that his brilliant athleticism and his perspective might even be a detriment to him a little bit. Like, he gets it. It's not that important. There's bigger things in life. He's so good. He never had to overwhelm you. And there's an interesting aspect to his game. It's the Julius Randle rule someone once told me about players is it, you can be enticed by the fact that Jeff Green can rebound and go down the length of the floor and he gets up above. Everyone has that great open court play. And you can get really, oh my gosh, there aren't many guys at that size and that. Okay, but there's probably somebody else on your roster who should be doing that instead. It's an interesting concept. So the Jazz decided that the Jeff Green just wasn't working. And that's a pretty bold move right there. They're hoping that George Niang can continue to bring great shooting. He plays hard and brings some aspect of the game. His numbers aren't much better, frankly. Like, let's be honest about it. Hopefully he's able to do that. They are hoping that Jarrell Brantley and some of these young guys can bring the Jazz some sort of energy. Juwan Morgan might be a little further away, but he's playing great in the G League. Jarrell Brantley is impressed. And, you know, maybe just some bees to the wall energy there is going to make a big difference. And see if that can get the Jazz going a little bit off the bench. The bench goes back to the game the other night. In the last 10 games, when George Niang has been playing, he's shooting 46% from the field, 43% from three. He is a minus five. His plus minus is no better. He's got 2 rebounds, but they're hoping that he'll increase some time on the floor. 1 of 7 last night wasn't great. That's probably a tough game for him. It's a highly athletic, big-time game for him. And so we'll see how that plays out. And there's an element. So let me get to now the next part, which is Rajon Tucker. So Rajon Tucker is an interesting story. Rajon, and I'm trying to find out more about it. I don't quite understand why all these things happened to him the way they did. But Rajon Tucker starts his career at Florida Gulf Coast. This guy is a world-class, unbelievable athlete. 6'5", 210, built, physically built. You watched Miami last night. Those guys are all really big and really strong. And this guy goes to the Florida Gulf Coast, and he comes off the bench for 2 years there. And honestly, what I don't understand is, like, he's from Charlotte, North Carolina. At 6'5", 210, and I don't know if it was a test score thing or some stupid NCAA thing or something. Like, why does he end up at Florida Gulf Coast? And I haven't had time to figure it out or make enough phone calls to find out. Because, like, there's no way an athlete of this level should be able to jump, you know, to not, like, I don't know, like, he should be playing somewhere other than Florida Gulf Coast. Now, frankly, in his 2 years at Florida Gulf Coast, he didn't do amazing things, right? Like, he's absolutely a world-class athlete that maybe just wasn't ready to be a basketball player. And so when he finally gets there, he plays 2 years. He did have a marijuana possession at one point in time, like, it doesn't move my meter. Anyway, Florida Gulf Coast, plays there for 2 years, and then he transfers and spends a single year last year at Little Rock. He graduates, he's graduated now, and he's going to be a grad transfer to Memphis under Penny Hardaway, but instead goes out for the draft. He shot 41% on threes at Little Rock last year on six attempts a game. So not like no attempts, six attempts, like pretty high number. Goes undrafted, which I'm just like, I've watched the highlights. I've talked to people. 6'5", 210, bowling ball strength, incredible strength, top of the square athleticism. And he goes to the G League and he goes bananas. His coach, Chase Buford, son of R.C. Buford, the great GM in San Antonio, like, is effusive about this guy. Effusive. Like, and talking around to people, there's the thought on him a little bit is, like, well, I ask, can he be a rotation player? And, like, people ask, have answered that people who know him think he can be, like, a legitimate NBA, like, starter. I it seems like a tremendous leap for me. But in 16 games in the G League, he averaged 24 points. He shot 39% from three. And he just went nuts recently. He went 30-30-30-30-30-30-30, right? 35 against Fort Wayne, 35 against Austin, 34 against Salt Lake, 36 against Canton. And five teams were bidding for him yesterday. It was suddenly a absolute bidding war for Rajon Tucker, and the Jazz got him in front of, I think it was four or five other teams from what I've heard. And they guaranteed him for a year. And so now all of a sudden the Jazz have done something really interesting. The Jazz have got three guys in kind of this similar mode, similar size, and maybe even four in Mia One, in Jarrell Brantley, Juwan Morgan, Rajon Tucker, who are probably the three best players in the G League so far this year. Now, finding talent in the G League has gotten more and more difficult because you have 15 players on every NBA roster, which is 450 players, plus you have another 62-way guys. So you've got to find somebody who has slipped through the top 500 players in the world. And the Jazz, I think, have found three of them. Now, Jarrell Brantley's a little different because he's on a two-way. And when you have Mike Conley earning 30 and Rudy Gobert earning 30, you are going to be able to sign one of three, and Donovan eventually making 30. You're going to end up signing one of three, and Joe Ingles making whatever he is, and Bojan making 20 or whatever it is. Like, you are going to be able to sign one of three types of players. And those one of three types of players are veterans like Jeff Green. So long-time standing veterans at the second stage of their career. They either adjust or don't adjust to playing 16 minutes a night. Emmanuel Mudiay, players on their second or third contract with a lot of talent, that haven't really learned how to play, and you're trying to teach them how to play the game differently. And the Jazz are doing a great job on that. Or three, these type of kids. These Jarrell Brantley, Rajon Tucker, Juwan Morgan. Morgan's probably got some body work to do, but his game's terrific, and he's developing beautifully. Jarrell Brantley's got this gift of a body, and he's got to narrow his game down. I don't know enough about Rajon Tucker on what he's got to do. And you're going to find these guys. And frankly, Jordan Clarkson kind of fits into that Emmanuel Mudiay mode. But Juwan Morgan's interesting. Juwan Morgan's suddenly shooting 55% from three and 2 3 attempts a game. He had 18 against Grand Rapids with 13 rebounds. He had 26 against Wisconsin in that game against Rajon Tucker. He had 20 against the Sky Force. He had 17 against Santa Cruz and 11 rebounds. He's playing great. 6'7", 232. He's probably got to slim down a tiny bit and become a four in the league. And Jarrell Brantley's got this incredible body. He's a little wild and crazy with the ball because at College of Charleston, he did everything, and now he's got to reduce it down. But the Jazz have gone and got themselves a bunch of these players, and I still am a big fan of Mione and put this all together. All right, that was a really long special edition, but it'll have to last till Friday. Hope you enjoy it. We'll talk to you after the game against Portland. Thanks very much. Have a happy holidays. This has been a special edition of Locked On Jazz.